the ever-growing orange signs on our region's roadways, we're confident in saying that spring has sprung. Confirming our research, we've consulted the daffodils and tulips and a growing number of people doing yard work on Saturdays. Yes, you found yourself in another exciting edition of After Office Hours with the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster. It's here that you'll find an ongoing conversation about our Puget Sound regional economy. We record this podcast about 1 month after posting our quarterly forecast and report as a way to expand on the report, but also to have you chance to engage in some of the same discussions we're having every day in our office. Today is April 16th, 2024, as we hit record. Depending on when and where you're listening, we may have fallen into an alternative universe. So as always, we highly advise you to look both ways and do not run with scissors or random internet sources. As we prepared for our discussion today, the volume of topics we could discuss was overwhelming. There is simply a lot to consider with the broader economy and how it impacts our corner of the world. Some things have been expected continuations from before, but we've had at least a few walk-ons that deserve attention. With that, I will leave it to our guest today to color in the year ahead. Let's see who we have on deck today for this economic dive. Dr. Hart Hodges is an economics professor at Western Washington University. Hart writes the regional forecast article and will occasionally contribute other articles based on the topics. Hart and I both co-direct the Center for Economic and Business Research at Western. James Mark Betta is our research economist and maintains all the switches, dials, and occasional pulleys of our many models while providing a wide array of insights into the forecast. James Mark writes many of the articles in each quarter as well as the monthly updates for our digital subscribers. And speaking of walk-ons, we invite Matthew Gardner to sit with us today. For the past 28 years, he specialized in analyzing and interpreting economic data and its impact on the real estate market across the United States. Matthew currently sits on the Washington State Governor's Council of Economic Advisors and is an advisory board member at the Runstead Center for Real Estate Studies at the University of Washington, where he also lectures in real estate economics. My name is James McCafferty, and I serve as the general manager and publisher for the report. But it's a team that makes the magic happen, from outside partners and our center's own research staff, and for each of them, I am always grateful. Hart, I think we need to talk to the manager here. First, I was promised a recession, then I was promised a whole series of rate cuts, and then I was told to prepare for a soft landing. The staff of this establishment just doesn't seem to deliver. Can you bring them to speed on what I should be expecting here in terms of rates, inflation, soft landing? And frankly, that soft landing, starting to look more like a takeoff than a landing.
You want clarity on rates, inflation, anything else on your list?
No, I think that'll do it for today.
I think the starting point is to remember that we're only in the middle of this movie. It's not necessarily winding down. So I'm going to be in the Jamie Dimon camp and say that a lot of people are betting on soft landing or no landing, or acting as though that's certain, and a lot of things have to go right still. And whether you think geopolitical or just political, I'm not so sure you're going to get some of what you just wanted. We're just slow in this establishment. All right, rates. We're going to have to talk about that in different settings in this podcast. You've got sticky inflation, which has led some in the Fed to say either no cuts, some people projecting possible a rate increase. Politics are going to enter that, and I think you're seeing enough weakness, especially in the small business side. The Fed is going to have to decide, and soon, do they remain reactionary and data dependent, or do they start taking a lead? And I think if they look at business weakness, you may still get a cut this summer, but I don't want to take it. We could talk a long time about just this landing. I want to make sure we hear as much as we can from Matthew, because we don't get him on the show too often. So I'll stop there, but I'll come back to it, because I've got to have a couple of questions for everybody else.
All right, we're going to line up for those. So Matthew, let's throw you under the bus here. So I read this week about Japan and EU looking at their rates. Seems like they're looking at cuts while the U.S. is standing tight. In fact, I read this morning that the rate increase could even be on the horizon here, based on the strong data that's come out this week. Can you talk me through why and what's going on in the national or global economy stage here around why would some countries be looking at rate cuts and the United States might be looking at rate increases or holding tight? That seems out of alignment, just thinking about global economies. So what's going on?
And that's true. I have to very briefly step back to what Hart said. He's saying he's in the Jamie Dimon camp. And Jamie's forecasted 9 out of the last 3 recessions. So it's interesting to see how well his prognostications continue. But anyway, that's by the by. Good morning. A couple of things, one of which is you're not exactly accurate on your introduction there, James. Yes, the ECB certainly is thinking about cutting rates, but Japan, for the first time, I think in what, 17 years, they're actually going to raise short-term rates. They're actually going to get back into positive territory. So we've got two things to look at here. Briefly, Japan, all you and all your listeners, I'm sure, are aware, they've been suffering from secular stagnation, I guess, the best way I can put it, and deflation for the last two decades. And in order to combat this, they lowered rates, even went, as I mentioned earlier, into negative territory about 8 years ago to stimulate the economy. Well, they're seeing healthy inflation starting to take root, and not to the extent that it's going to counter the decent wage growth. So I think that's good. They're actually getting back into one positive territory and to actually starting to raise rates. Now, the EU, that's a very different story. I certainly expect to see Chris Lagarde and the ECB raise rates as they think they have inflation in check. I expect them to announce their first rate cut after their June meeting. So certainly not that far away. Now, why are they doing this and we're not? Well, for comparison purposes, headline inflation in the Eurozone running about 2.4% year on year through March, down from 2.6 annually the month before. And as we all know, here we're at 3.5, up from 3.2. So they are certainly a number of steps ahead of us when it comes to taming inflation. But my concern is that while the slowing European economy is certainly going to benefit from lower rates, an early cut, well, that could encourage investors to move capital out of Europe, right? And that would further weaken the euro. That supports exports and growth, which is a good thing, but it could actually then drive inflation back up again. So you've got to be a little bit cautious. Now, there, I think that they are certainly in a better place. Here, as we all know, inflation's remarkably sticky. Two things are hurting more than anything else. Car insurance, up by, 22% year on year, and shelter. Shelter's been the bane of my life, and that's housing. Because of the way it's calculated. It's done in a way, quite frankly, that we don't see anywhere else in the world. In fact, Europe say, well, we can't figure out how to do it, so we're just not going to include it. Maybe we should start thinking about that. But that is one of the things that is holding inflation higher than we'd like to see. It is sticky coming down. Question is, are we going to see cuts? I hope we don't see a rate increase. That would be very disruptive to the global markets. But yeah, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me at all if we don't see any rate cuts at all. If we do, well, it's going to be September, but my bigger concern more than anything else is what happens in November. You can't cut any later than that without it being considered to be a political move. So there's lots of moving parts here, as Hart mentioned.
Right, James, before we pull in James Mark, not right this second, but I want to get Matthew's thoughts on wealth effects. We have the stock market, we have home prices, and so on. Is a wealth effect part of the inflation story that's complicating? So we can keep going, but I want to weave that in at some point.
Matthew, I've got a couple follow-ons I want to ask you. So I read this morning also about strengthening U.S. dollar, especially against China and some other countries. I believe it's India seems to be having a very small currency effect. Is there any connection between the strength of currencies and these rates and inflation, et cetera? I mean, help me connect the dots there for just a quick second. As a listener here, I might be trying to thread that needle. So what needle is there to be thread?
Well, I mean, arbitrage is not the world in which I live. I know enough to be dangerous in that respect. But I think, well, certainly we're seeing a lot of emerging countries, certainly India. I think that there's an acronym for it, China, India, a couple of other currencies who are looking to push the dollar out of being the de facto global currency. I don't see that happening, quite frankly. Now, there are those who will argue, you know, since Nixon got us off the gold standard, what really supports the dollar? Well, what supports the dollar is a $27 trillion a year economy. So I think that, and it's also, the dollar, by the way, is the de facto currency for 37 countries outside of America. So I don't see that changing. Strength of the dollar is good and bad in some respects. Obviously, it makes our exports more expensive. And that can be the benefit of China, because, again, we buy a lot from them. So, yes, there are certainly machinations around the globe relative to currencies. But I'm not seeing anything specifically that is of abject concern.
All right. And the other piece I want to have in it, I struggle with where to bring this up today, so let's just cover it here. So let's talk about the wealth effect on all of these on the economy. Talk to us a few minutes about what your take is on that.
Yeah, increasing bifurcation is what we're seeing. The rich are getting richer, everyone else isn't. And quite frankly, there's a lot of reasons for it, but a lot of it is technology. And why do I say that? Well, the middle classes were created, as we know, mid-18th century. Industrial Revolution, that kind of thing. Well, now we're seeing more automation take over. So we are seeing that increasing bifurcation, certainly when it comes to home ownership, for example. The Fed puts out a fascinating paper every 3 years, which looks at the median net wealth of a homeowner household in America relative to a renter household in America. Just published their most recent data. Incredible. The median wealth of a homeowner household in this country is around $400,000. The median household wealth for a renter household in America today is, drumroll, $10,000. This comes straight from the Fed. So in that, literally, it is quite extraordinary, that fact. They run this analysis every 3 years. So when I look at it, they also put out a lot of other fascinating data bits as well, which looks at the net wealth of the top 1%, 1 to 10, et cetera. Well, I grabbed that data and throw it into a kind of a model which I've had forever. And all of a sudden, it wasn't working. Like, why isn't it working? They changed the parameters. Now the wealthiest is the top 0.1%. And so they literally have gone to that point. I mean, the top 10% of the nation owns half the nation's wealth. So it is a scary place to be. How can change the state? Home ownership certainly is a significant part of it. Also, inflation. And certainly think about goods inflation has a disproportionately negative impact on lower income households who spend a greater amount of their income on food, quite frankly. So it's we're really seeing they're not going forward in any respect. As much as wages are up, we're still looking at what, just shy of 5% annualized wage growth right now, according to the Atlanta Fed. But that can be good. But when you're spending so much of your income on nutrition and shelter and rent, certainly, it's very hard to start saving. And that's where the select households in this country have a very significant advantage.
And you let the stimulus money, considerable stimulus money, pushed into the economy as it ripples through the economy, and I think builds up in some of the assets that are owned by, right? So you get a compounding effect of stimulus rippling through longer than we may have expected, compounding that wealth effect, and here we go, inflation sticky. Oh,
very much so. And then all of a sudden you're in cash right now. I mean, you're making 5% on 90-day paper. if you've got a decent amount of money, that's not chump change by any stretch of the imagination. Right. And again, that increases that bifurcation.
All right. So that all ripples us back down. So James Mark, this is where I'm going to start asking you about normal people and consumers. Okay, maybe not normal people. But James Mark, I want you to talk about how people are reacting and thinking about this. I've seen a lot of angst about cost of living in terms of grocery store prices, insurance lately, cost of housing. I mean, these are all things that we've been talking about here so far as well. But some of it's linked to higher interest rates. Some of it's loosely connected. What do we know about consumer behavior? Since it's one thing to be concerned, it's another one to take action. So what are consumers actually doing with all of this angst?
Well, James, that's a very good question. First of all, it's important to acknowledge that consumer spending or consumer behavior in general is crucial to the economy because consumer spending contributes about 68% to GDP last quarter. So again, if consumer spending is increasing, it means that some sectors, for example, like the retail sector is increasing. So for example, census data recently showed that retail sales is up by 0.7%, which is an indication that spending is up and it's good for the economy to some extent. But there are some concerns which are legitimate because, for example, credit card debt are high, delinquency rates are going up, and recent data published by S&P Global Market Intelligence shows that the trend of delinquency rates from last quarter is continuing in the first quarter of 2024. But there are some good news, like Matthew already mentioned, wages are up. But the point is that wage increases are not up to the point that it could offset the impact of interest rate hikes and also the impact of prices. Currently, as of March, we have CPI rose to about 3.5%. Now, the complication of high interest rates, high debt, and also delinquency rates is for sure going to make the life of the ordinary consumer complicated. Now, the question is, as a consumer, are you ready to make the hard choices to forego some discretionary expenditure? For instance, we are getting to the summer, and we know in the summer, a hotel reservation and all these travel expenses are going to be up. As a consumer, are you ready to forego some of these things and make the hard decisions of cutting down some of the expenditure on this and be able to cut down your debt? And or are you debt going to keep spending? These are critical decisions that as households, consumers, we have to take. So again, it's complicated for the consumer, but we have to make hard decisions as to what to spend on and what not to spend on as a consumer.
So as usual, a mixed bag. I mean, some people are making some decisions and other people are making other decisions. I did read the other day that business travel continues to be low and yet air traffic remains to be high. So we've got a lot of people out traveling. I don't know. I think that the age of revenge travel has got to be over. So we'll have to come up with a new title. Why consumers seem to be traveling so much now. All right. So that brings us back to we've talked about housing costs several times. So let's talk about residential real estate. Matthew, there's a lot to unpack in this space, right? Interest rates, inventory, construction costs, zoning changes, density implications, downtown or suburbs, square foot demands. And then we have changes in commission structures that have come out, which I have found amusing that people think that's going to lower the cost of housing. So maybe you can set me straight on that. I have to be honest, it feels like a hot mess of data, rumors, innuendos. It's just a lot that goes on in this sector. Census today released their latest data point on new residential construction is being down 14.7 for last month, but February was up 12.7, and there's a lot of cyclical there, and I'm sure you'll set me straight on that as well, too. We're coming into traditional peak season for real estate. This is when a lot of property is listed and sold. Can you tell me about what's really important to be watching and what you think of the Puget Sound region's residential real estate market?
A lot more interest inventory from your mouth to the big one's ears. That is the big issue we have today, James, and it's supply. It's not a demand issue, it's massively a supply one. And the market is supply starved. There's no question about it. So why? I mean, although if you look at inventory levels, they are up from where we saw in 2021 and 2022, but they are well below the levels. And our data goes back about 35 years. It's a ludicrously low number of people choosing to sell. Why? Very simple. 80% of Washingtonians who have a mortgage of a single family home have a mortgage rate at or below 5%. But it gets better. 27% have a mortgage rate at 3% or lower. So kind of riddle me this. Why would you move where today's rates, and certainly we were all watching 10-year paper go parabolic today, when rates are north of 7% and getting up towards 7.5%. So we have way too many households wearing so-called golden handcuffs. And that is keeping supply levels down, because if you don't have to move, you're not. We are still seeing transactions. Of course we are. For three of the four normal reasons that happens. Job change, death, and divorce. But we're not seeing it for the fourth D, discretionary. And unfortunately, and almost perversely, it's this lack of supply that is supporting home prices. Now, go back to Econ 101, right? Limit supply, still have net new demand. What happens to prices? They go up. Even in a mortgage rate environment that we have today, which is the highest we've seen in decades. So you might ask, well, why are people still buying? Well, they're hedging. They believe, as I do, that rates will come down at some point. Then they will refinance and everything's going to be good. So that is where we are today. Do I expect to see an increase in supply? Yes, modestly, hopefully in the second half of this year, but not by much. So we'll probably see transactions up maybe 5 to 10%, depending on where you are. But it's really going to be incumbent on where mortgage rates are. Now, people don't need to get the same rate that they have in order for them to move. But when you get to within about 1.5 to 2 points of the current rate you have, well, then you feel less change to your house. So I think that will start freeing up some inventory. But the problem we've got, it's almost like the prisoner's dilemma, right? Game theory. If I don't think there's something out there to buy, I'm not going to sell. and I'm not going to sell, but I don't think there's something out there to buy. So we kind of get stuck. And so affordability is what I've been moaning on about forever, is my biggest concern. I did a study a week or so ago. Last year, a buyer making, or household making median income in the state, they'd have to have dedicated 42% of their gross income to mortgage payments. It's ludicrous. So this, again, is creating that divergence of the haves and the have-nots. So my bigger worry than anything else is first-time buyers. Where are these young people going to be able to buy? Builders, as you mentioned, aren't building, and that is very true. And they're not, again, because of price. Land is expensive. Labor is expensive. There are fewer people working single-family construction in America today than there were back in 2005. A long time. So land is expensive. Labor is expensive. Materials, better than they were, but still expensive. And finally, regulatory fees. So it's you combine all those things together, a builder will do that, figure out his financing costs, which are naturally higher as well. That will spit out a price you have to sell the home for. Well, if that price is 40% above where the market would accept, will they build it? No, they won't. So that's where we stand today. So I think we will have a market. And I guess the last part of that would be, what are people talking to me about? The murmurs of housing bubbles are out there again. Ludicrous. Absolutely not the case. We are massively overqualified to buy our homes. And we're also sat on a ton of equity. So that's kind of really briefly where we are today in the residential market in our region and nationally.
Matthew, it's remarkable the urge right now on small, right? So we can talk about tiny homes. We can talk about ADUs. We can talk about micro apartments. We can talk about and none of these are new ideas. They're just they've caught a resurgence, I think, from people just trying to find something affordable and looking for solutions that might not be as distasteful as other solutions, I suppose.
Well, the choice of micro apartments and ADUs, they benefit the rental community. They don't benefit homeowners. And so often with ADUs, and yes, if somebody's smart, they'll do a condo map on it. So at some point, if they want to sell it, they can. But generally speaking, they're renting them out. So again, this is not helping a generation. Don't forget, the older millennials, I don't really care about them. They're turning 40 anyway. Hey, I'm Gen Z. Well, we just hate everyone. But it's the younger millennials, I'm not Gen Z, I'm Gen X. The younger millennials and Gen Z behind them. It's going to create a wave of would-be home buyers, and they do want to buy. I mean, my son's a sophomore at college, not your one, I'm afraid, but and my concern is by the time he gets done there and grad school, where's he going to be able to afford to buy a home? He's not moving back in with me.
Matthew, normally when interest rates move up, we expect home prices to go down. They didn't because of the supply issue you talked about. Could we have something perverse in the other direction? So as rates start to come back down, you know, mortgages are cheaper, prices can move up. Could we see enough of a push in supply, pent up people that on that discretionary side, that an increase in supply keeps housing prices from going back up when interest rates come down?
I don't think it's so hard. I mean, yes, you could see it would require a number of things. One, we'd have to see builders go parabolic. That's unlikely to happen. We're creating a lot of households, and that is only going to continue. And as we do that, shelter is a requirement. So arguably, do I like any housing market in the country which is seeing price growth in double digits? No, and that is clearly unsustainable. We know that. Right. Historically, in Western Washington, 4.5% to 5% is kind of pretty much where it's been on average, going back to about 1990. And that's it, accounting for the 2007 through 2011 drop in prices. So no, I mean, could we see them see a very low rate of growth? I'd have no problem with that. I mean, nationally, over the last 110 years, home prices got by inflation, what they did. When we know that, if you look at gold case Shiller stuff. So I think that I want to see more supply. That would certainly help, but I want to see slower price growth. But arguably, we've only seen two periods that I'm aware of. We've actually seen a systemic decline in home values. One was in the early 90s, and then obviously the housing bubble bursting. So that tends not to happen. I think it would require everyone to move, but if everyone's moving, where are they moving to? They're not all moving to Yuma, Arizona to retire. That's a big thing as well, by the way, is retirees. We're not retiring. We're not moving. And we're not downsizing, which limits this supply of houses that appeal to move up buyers. So they're not moving. And if they're not moving, what happens to the first time buyers? And we finally had a lot because older homeowners, for want of a better word, they want to stay close to the kids because their own biological clock is ticking. They want grandchildren. But they've also got too much stuff the kids don't want. And finally, the big thing is they think if they downsize, the children won't come and visit. So they're either not moving or they're moving parallel. They're moving sideways. This is a very strange situation.
You know, Matthew, we shared some great infographics. I think I borrowed them from the Wall Street Journal this past week on our social media about boomers not moving. There's some great infographics out. So listeners, you can go data mine our social media feed, go back, a ways, and you'll find those. But they're truly interesting. James, Mark, I think we'd be remiss if we don't weave something about construction here. We've kind of touched upon it in multiple ways, but what are you seeing within the residential and commercial sectors in our finely tuned crystal ball?
Great, James. Again, that is a great question. And this question is not much different from what Matthew and Hart have mentioned about the real estate market, because basically what we are seeing is that construction of new homes is up by about 5.7% the last quarter. And again, which it signals that, well, supply has been on the shortage, but things are picking up a little bit. Even though interest rates is still high, construction is still coming up a little bit. So we hope to see that trend continues and see how it's going to impact prices going forward. But I think we can confidently say that the trend has continued since last quarter, and the housing market continue, for that matter, construction continue to be a bit tight. One other issue which is kind of concerning is the rate at which employment is decreasing in the construction sector. Even though construction of new homes are up a little bit, across the forecast that we did, for example, for the state of Oregon, Washington, and California, in all these states, construction sector has shredded jobs in this quarter, which is quite not encouraging. But we hope that this trend tends down going forward.
That answered that James Mark's comment. You mentioned California. I mean, California's lost population for the last 3 years in a row. That's never happened in history. So it's mass migration out of the state. A couple of reasons. One, it's taxes, both property and income taxes. But secondly, it's climate. They're getting sick and tired of fires, floods, pestilence, disease, and their governor. So anyway, what we're seeing is they're moving out. A lot of them are coming up this direction. And again, because of climate. So we in Western Washington, it's almost becoming the Riviera of the Northwest. As our weather gets better, it attracts more people here. So they're not surprised to see the plus fact is very hard to build in California anyway, as it is here. So, but losing population does not bode well for new housing construction in the great state of California.
Great. Thanks for that info.
I think I read that California's population is starting to grow again, but that doesn't mean all the factors that you just mentioned, Matthew, don't hold true and aren't,
Yeah, I mean, we got the latest 2023 census data. And so, yeah, it is fascinating. And obviously I look at it a lot closer for Washington State. But yeah, you are still seeing more births than deaths there, which is good, which is something, by the way, there are more counties in Washington State last year, more people died than were born. But it is that migration, both domestic and international. And so that's still, I think, a continuation post-COVID. You're moving to cheaper areas because of remote working. So yes, we are still adding population, but the population growth nationally has been slowing dramatically. I think that will continue. Again, blame those millennials and ones that are coming up behind them. Fewer kids or no kids. And so I think at some point we're going to potentially be in the same predicament that Xi Jinping found in China, where up until relatively recently, you know, have one kid, better be a boy, and you get a tax break. Now have three kids, we don't care if it's a boy or a girl, get a tax break, because they realize the median age of their population was 65.
Okay. All right, so many tangents to follow on the demographic side. We'll avoid the immigration and all of how that can ripple through construction and so on. I want to steer things, if I can, towards commercial real estate. Matthew, we've been talking in the office. One of the things that came up, Bloomberg had a report, now it's last fall, so very dated.
essentially asking developers and property owners, when will you feel the pain of the higher rates? And similar to the residential market where they'd locked into lower rates to the best they can, now there's no 30-year fixed equivalent in the commercial world, but the answer was essentially, if rates stay higher into the second half of 2024, we're going to feel some pain. And I just want to use that thought as a segue or a teaser. What are you seeing on the commercial side?
Yeah, and you're right. Let's start with your first point. Yes, there is no equivalent to a 30-year fixed mortgage. Because the question I get posed mainly by reporters is this. And 40% of all commercial real estate loans are going to become due in the next 3 years. What's your comment? Well, my comment is 40% of real estate loans become due every 3 years. It's how they're financed. So we are seeing a lot of people trying to pushing pretty hard on that. But I'll kind of give you some numbers. It's always find it a bit easier to explain. Nationally, the value of commercial real estate today is around just shy of $18 trillion, of which there is debt outstanding of just shy of $6 trillion, about a third. So there's still a lot of in the bank still, shall we say, in terms of any over concern on debt and leverage. Now, at office specifically, yeah, we've got a vacancy rate at 20% in Q1 here in the Puget Sound, a bit higher at 23.6. So that is not good. But look at it in a slightly different way. So one of which is, yeah, we do know, again, it's financed differently. The value based upon cap rates, based upon vacancy, obviously, that's a problem because it means the value of the asset is actually going down. But what we saw is that there's a lot of kicking the can down the road has already happened, meaning that loans that were due in 2023 now becoming due this year. In fact, there's about $930 billion which will be due this year. And then it drops to about $575 billion the following year. So what do I see? Delinquency rates are up. Yeah, no, but it, I mean, they're still lower than we saw in 2017. No, 2007, 2008. So am I believing that we're in an environment today that means we're going to see a kind of entire commercial real estate market collapse? No, I don't. Will there be some pain? Yes, there will. The pain's that, quite frankly, are going to come small banks. And I say that, and they will be foreclosures, but it's not the big institutions. So the big banks, ones with assets of above about $250 billion, they only hold about 11% of total commercial real estate debt. And that's only about a fifth of their entire debt load. However, small banks, these are ones with assets of below $20 billion. They have 28.5% of commercial real estate debt, and that equates to over half of their total debt load. So that is a scary place to be. So I think that we will certainly see some foreclosures. We will see some buildings be taken back by the bank, but the bank doesn't want to do it. It doesn't have to. If it takes it back, then they have to take the loss. And that's when it hits their books. So they don't want to go down that road if it's all possible. We'll see some refinancing. We'll see some transactions. There's a lot of dry institutional powder out there to buy. And so it is a problem. I mean, if you are a owner of commercial real estate or a lender in that world, yeah, you've probably got some heartburn. And I think that's going to continue through this year. But is it going to be another apocalyptic collapse as we saw in the housing market a decade or so ago? No, I don't see that happening. But then we will lose some more smaller banks. And finally, on that part, again, I'm always asked, why don't we convert all these office buildings into housing? Solve the crisis. Doesn't work. Anything built post about 1980. Two very simple reasons. One, poor depth. It means you'll be creating nothing more than a whole bunch of bowling alley units with no natural light. Secondly, is plumbing penetration. Now, you've got to have plumbing to all the units, and that makes it very expensive. And thirdly, you're not going to be given the building for nothing. So low rise, older. Yeah, we could see some conversions. A friend of mine in Boston actually is doing a bigger building, only doing it because he's actually able to, in essence, he's cutting out the entire middle of the building. I don't know how the hell he's able to do that financially, but that's what's going on right now. But the view of let's see all these conversions, that saved the day. But I don't see it. But also, I don't see us ever going back to a world whereby professional business services, i.e. office users, are back in the offices 5 days a week. That's gone. I don't think it's ever going to come back.
All right. We just gave you, as a listener, a lot of information. So I'm going to ask for the quick summary here. So my challenge My challenge for each of you is 30 seconds or less with your answer here. So that's a tall order for each of you. I'm pretty sure of it. But in 30 seconds, I'm interested in what each of you are seeing on the road ahead for the next 12 months for the region. So Matthew, being the guest, let's have you go first. That way, no one can steal your answer. What's in the road ahead for the next 12 months?
So kind, James. Biggest thing, Lightning will be treading water the second half of the year. Why? What goes on in November? And there'll be a lot of concern or question as to who's going to be in the White House in January. I think that's causing a lot of angst, not just domestically, also, I'd say, globally. So watch that. I think inflation, I'm not in the Jamie Dimon camp, hard, I'm afraid. I don't see, again, a complete meltdown. But I would not be surprised to see interest rates not come down this year. I think if they don't do it in September, they won't do it until early next year. And so are we in a terrible place from a perspective of inflation? I'll talk hours about that. Won't. It is going to slowly come down, certainly on PCE. But inflation slowing modestly, lightly, fewer rates. Let's see who's going to be in the White House. And that's going to be maybe we'll chat again after the election.
That sounds like a good time. Hart, what do you see? Road ahead, 12 months.
You know, I'm going to say something similar. The Jamie Dimon article that I was referencing just said he puts the odds of a recession at 50-50, or puts the odds of a no landing at no better than 50%. Mm-hmm. I think there's just a lot of uncertainty. I agree that the Fed has to lower once, summer or September. It's got to be for economic reasons, not political. At least they've got to be able to spin it that way. And then they're on hold. Something that we haven't talked about, and I wish we had more time. What do downtowns look like? What do cities do to try to be more innovative as we go through this hybrid work experiment, or as we move into this new hybrid world? I think my 30 seconds is up. I'm going to watch that, because I think how well cities deal with that is going to be crucial going forward.
All right. James, Mark, what do you see?
Right. So I would kind of reference recently forecast. So we are forecasting that per the blue chip forecast, we are seeing that we expect GDP to grow by about 1.7% as of by 2025. And IMF is also projecting same, which signals that we are not close to recession going forward. And also, like Hart and Matthew mentioned, inflation, I also expect inflation to come down. But we should also be mindful of the external factors. For example, the conflict in Middle East, which can hugely affect energy prices and fuel prices. So even if Fed cuts rates to kind of, if the effect of Fed interest rate is still stabilizing prices, there is that chance that external factors could, you know, work against inflation and we could not to reach the Fed target of 2%. So again, we have to also watch out for external factors, given these things that are happening in the Middle East.
Awesome. I think my road ahead is there's going to be a lot of economists talking in the news for the next 12 months. I think that's the safest forecast I can offer. So, James, Mark, we create monthly updates, and those went up yesterday. So anything I should be looking forward to reading in those?
Absolutely. There are fantastic news there. So if you are looking out for updates about what is going on in the region in terms of employment, in terms of which sector is shredding jobs and which sector is expanding, it's a great place for you to go to read on our current economic indicators. And if you are into the real estate and other areas, you want to know about what is happening in the Boeing industry, the aerospace sector, please read our monthly index. You get updated on issues as to which of these, how the rate of unemployment is in the region, what is happening to unemployment insurance claim, all these are updated on in there. So it's definitely a great place for our subscribers to look at.
You know, I was going to avoid talking about Boeing today, and now you've opened that can of worms. We'll let that go. We'll come back to that maybe in the next podcast. By then, maybe we'll have a better idea of what's going on there with the Lazy Bee. That brings us to a close of this edition of After Office Hours with the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster. We encourage you to follow us on social media to have your front row seat of reading over our shoulders on a daily basis and learn about other ways to connect with us. You can also reach us via our website, that's cebr.ww.edu, or by email at cebr@ww.edu. With questions, comments, or if you're interested in having us come speak at your event, we do take this on the road, and we entertain audiences well, maybe entertainment's the wrong word. We have a great time with audiences and talking about the economy. After Office Hours with the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster is a production of the Center for Economic and Business Research at Western Washington University. We want to give a big thank you to our guest, Matthew Gardner, for agreeing to join us today. That'll be a mistake he will not make again, I'm sure. And we also want to give a big shout out to our producer, Jill Poon, who makes us all sound really great. We appreciate her work with KDMC and our making our podcast a reality. To learn more about the topics discussed today, please visit us at economicforecaster.com and subscribe to our quarterly report. Subscribe to After Office Hours for the Puget Sound Economic Forecaster on Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Transistor, or wherever you happen to listen to podcasts. From all of us at Western Washington University, have a great day.